From Elwives to Zooplankton, the status of Maine's marine resources. There's a lot that might keep Pat Kelleher awake at night. As Commissioner of Maine's Department of Marine Resources, he's in charge of managing a host of commercial fisheries that are facing new and changing pressures, some of which are not clearly understood. Warming waters in the Gulf of Maine are believed to be a factor in why Maine shrimp stocks are in trouble. Herring, a critical source of bait for lobstermen, are also dwindling, forcing the industry to scramble to find other sources. And there are big questions about what changing ecosystems mean for lobsters themselves. Aquaculture has the potential for growth, but how fast and at what cost? I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we'll talk with Commissioner Pat Kelleher about these and other major issues affecting the state's marine resources. And as always, we want to hear from you. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. It's a big job staying on top of everything happening in and around Maine's coastal waters. But that is what today's guest does. Commissioner Pat Kelleher joins me in our Augusta studio today to talk about the status of Maine's marine resources, our fisheries, aquaculture, whales, warming waters, and more. Kelleher has been the commissioner of Maine's Department of Marine Resources since 2011. He has also served as director of the Bureau of Sea Run Fisheries and Habitat. And in the past, he was executive director of the Coastal Conservation Association of Maine, and he was a registered Maine guide. Thank you for joining us, Commissioner.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And as always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have for Commissioner Kelleher? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. We'll start out big. We've got an hour. So I want to just talk a little bit about what your job in the context of thinking about climate change, which is an enormous subject. But as the head of the department that's charged with protecting our marine environment, how do you factor in, or can you, the anticipated changes in water temperature or acidity or increased rain and runoff into regulatory strategies? Can you, or do you have to manage in much more manageable sized?
A little of both, depending on the issue. We are dealing with a changing environment, there's no question. We deal with warming waters. The Gulf of Maine is warming faster than almost every body of water on the planet. When you hear that type of information, it's people kind of try to have a hard time grasping with that, because we're only talking about 2, 3, 4 degree water temperature changes. But those are drastic changes when it comes to marine fisheries. That equates to good and bad. The lobster resource in particular, we've seen an expansion of habitats. We've seen, as that habitat expands, we see improved settlement. We see growth in populations, and that's why we're seeing catches of over 100 million pounds with a fishery that predominantly ran around 20 to 40 million pounds of landing. So obviously that is the big issue for the state of Maine, and the big values. Nearly $500 million in landed value from lobster alone. But then you have the negatives, the invasive species, the green crab issues in particular, and their impact to soft shell clams. You have fish like black sea bass that are coming in higher numbers. And, you know, those are the type of things. Black sea bass is a great example of potentially an opportunity in the future. But the quotas and the allocation of that species is done through the Mid-Atlantic Council, and we don't have quota associated with it. So if we had numbers, we have to figure out ways to have those tough conversations about quota redistribution of fish, whether it's shifting cod stocks or shifting black sea bass or as lobsters shift, what comes in behind them to replace them. So climate change and changing environments is a big driver in everything we do.
And are any of those species that are finding their way here moving in because of warmer waters, are they potentially predators of young lobster, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Black sea bass are made to eat small lobsters. As that population establishes itself, it certainly will have a negative effect on lobster. And we have to regulate them based on the Atlantic State Marine Fisheries Commission, and it becomes a struggle, and it becomes a very hard debate with some states, because states have to give up something for us to get something. So we continue to wrestle with those type of bigger management issues all the time through both the commission and the New England Fisheries Management Council process.
So it sounds like you're saying you're moving toward or have already arrived at more of an ecosystem management as opposed to individual single species regulation, or is it still a blend?
We're moving more and more towards ecosystems-based management, but it's not an easy thing to do because you're talking about combining single species management, breaking down silos, and trying to figure out a way to manage those stocks jointly. We're moving in that direction by taking those type of things into account with menhaden, for example. The recent actions on Atlantic herring, about how those stocks interact with other species and how you manage them for those other species benefits as well. So those are things that are happening now.
And we'll talk about herring and its relationship to the lobster fishery. But let's start with lobster, because it's the singular most important fishery we have, obviously.
Yep.
We know that sales are to China are being affected by tariffs, but that's not really your problem, is it?
No, I hear a lot about it from the lobster industry for sure, but those type of conversations really happen with the governor's office directly with the administration on trying to figure out ways to soften these impacts. Those trade negotiations are always ongoing.
But there are issues in the news that are affecting the lobster industry. One is this issue around concerns about protecting the right whale.
Correct.
And maybe you could help explain kind of where we are, but I'll just kick it off by saying that at issue is a concern expressed by federal regulators.
Correct.
That as the lobster fishery has moved offshore, they're alleging recently, I guess, that or making a conclusion that therefore the ropes being used in this offshore fishery are thicker and less, more of a threat, I guess, of entanglement.
Right.
You challenged that conclusion.
We did, and we continue to challenge that conclusion. The technical memo that was released for the take reduction team was supposed to set the stage for a conversation about the entire east coast of the United States and what needed to be done holistically to protect right whales. There are less than 500 right whales left, North Atlantic right whales left. They range up and down the entire east coast of the United States and now move all the way into Canada. Canada has little to no protections in place. They put dynamic management areas into place, and they closed large areas, which was a good first step. But their lobster industry is not stepping up, and the government has not stepped up to put protections in place like we have. We've got 20 years of history in this state of Maine and on the East Coast, with the lobster fishery in particular, to protect right whales. We've removed float rope from the fishery. We've gone to sinking ground lines. We've removed end lines. And the lobster industry in the state of Maine is prepared to do more, but we need to do it based on the best available science. And that technical memo that they released, we believe, is flawed. You mentioned the offshore fishery. They surmised that because we're catching more lobsters offshore, there must be more ropes in the water. That's not the case. You can't use landings as a proxy for rope. We just received a $700,000 grant from NOAA to do gear work and to do rope work associated to determine where those ropes are, how they're being fished, what the makeup of those ropes are, and in particular what the breaking strength of those ropes are. We're seeing very early indications of the ropes that are being used predominantly in the lobster fishery in Area 1 are not necessarily a problem. They'll say 80% of the whales have scars on them. That may be true, but to what effect? A scar does not mean mortality. So we're trying to figure out, okay, what's the right balance of gear and placement? But you have to understand, we're not seeing right whales in the Gulf of Maine. There were two inshore very early on when they left Massachusetts waters last year, but fishermen are not seeing right whales. because of that, even NOAA Fisheries stopped all of their overflights of the Gulf of Maine. NOAA is flying in Canada now to keep track of the right whales, not the Gulf of Maine.
Are you concerned, though, that there might be, that we're moving toward an endangered protection for right whales?
Well, they're already protected under the Endangered Species Act, and they're already protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And because of the protections in place by both of those federal acts, we're now facing, with the death of 17 whales last year, mostly from Canadian fishing. The ones that were linked to fishing gear were linked to Canadian fishing gear. We're now in a situation here in the United States of having to do more, but we need to do more based on proof that we're the problem, and we don't have that yet. We're still trying to figure out how that's going to come about.
The next level would be what, a jeopardy finding, or I'm not sure.
Under the Endangered Species Act, they're doing a biological opinion right now, and based on the loss of just the whales last year and two deaths this year. I don't have any doubt that they're going to find that fisheries in the United States are causing jeopardy to right whales. And if we are part of that problem, we want to be part of the solution. Lobstermen don't want to be impacting right whales.
And you said the industry is willing to do more. Would that include, fill us in about this too, ropeless traps?
Ropeless is 20 or 30 years away. The technology does not exist. You got to remember, we have a mobile gear fishery with draggers out there that need to understand where that lobster gear is. From an enforcement standpoint, we need to still enforce the conservation laws associated with the lobster fishery itself. And we would not be able to do that with ropeless fishing. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't still look at it for maybe future development, and maybe there is a benefit down the road. Maybe in Massachusetts Bay there could be a benefit in the closed areas down there. But right now we're a long ways away from going ropeless with this fishery.
Lobster continues in general to do well in terms of harvests and population. It kind of... it's a surprise, it seems like, every year, considering how much we harvest. But are you concerned about warming temperatures, or would the temperatures in off Maine waters have to rise significantly in order to drive lobster populations northward?
Yeah, so I am concerned. I'm concerned that we will continue to see shifting stocks. However, we are now continuing to see pretty decent settlement in most places of the coast. We're not seeing declines in our ventless trap survey numbers, those other indicators that we would have besides the harvest. So I think in the near term, things are looking good. Long term, if we continue to see warming waters, we will still see shifts in this population. And we just invested roughly $500,000 in a research collaborative to start to address some of these issues, to try to determine, okay, what do we need? What more information do we need to make sound management decisions in the future?
So the center of the lobster population is moving northward. That's sort of been...
When you say it's moving, it's a shifting population. The biomass shifts. It doesn't go away in an area. Even southern New England still has populations in areas of those bottom that maintains good catches. But, the western zones down in southern Maine, we'll still see catches of lobsters, but will they be as high as they have? Will we start to see those shift? Mid-coast and down East Maine in particular have had very high landings in the last 6 or 8 years. How will those shift? Will they shift offshore? Will we not see that in-migration of lobsters for the shed in the summer? Those are questions that we're still trying to wrestle with and what impacts will be.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation with Commissioner Pat Kelleher, Department of Marine Resources for the state of Maine. Other big issue in the news now for the lobster industry is bait.
Yeah.
And this is related to populations of herring, which have dropped significantly. Where are we in terms of setting a quota for next year, for example?
Yeah, so the New England Fisheries Management Council just took action to reduce the overall quotas, and we set what's called a 3-year specification package. However, these rules won't be in place in time for 2019. So the National Marine Fisheries Service is going to have to take action and set the 2019 quota, and then Both the commission and council will have input on developing quota numbers for 2020 and 2021. We're talking about a very serious hit here. We had quotas were over 100,000 metric tons. Over the last several years, we were catching around 50,000 metric tons. We'll be below that for 2018, closer to 42 to 48,000 metric tons. But the overall quota for 19 could be less than 20,000 metric tons. And when you take the set aside for fixed gear and the Canadian weir fishery, we're talking about potentially numbers of well below 20,000 metric tons. That's in millions of pounds, that's about a 40 to 50 million pound bait deficit for the fishery next year.
So how will the industry make that up? Through frozen bait from other states? Or
exactly. What they call hard baits or frozen baits. We have bait safety rules in place to ensure that they're not bringing in species that would be very problematic, carry diseases.
Can you give an example of what you're afraid of?
For instance, we had a request to bring in Vietnamese catfish. They're grown in ponds that have shrimp. Those shrimp carry white spot disease. White spot would be transmitted to shrimp, crabs, and lobsters here in the Gulf of Maine as kind of one of the biggest threats. VHS, which is a species that could be transmitted from fish to fish. Carp from the Midwest is a potential, and we do allow some carp to come in because we can, through chain of custody, show that it comes from areas where there are no signs of VHS. But others do show, and we work with the other states to determine where those safe areas and unsafe areas are before they come in. Menhaden's a big issue for us right now, too. Maine only has about 2.4 million pounds of menhaden quota. We were able to transfer from other states quota in, and we harvested this year probably closer to 14 million pounds of menhaden. So hopefully we'll see that number potentially grow a little bit next year. Those populations are very healthy, and I think we're managing that stock very sustainably.
But if you can't make up the difference here, yeah, from the herring, that's just going to force some people out of the business?
I'm not sure if it certainly is going to create a level of supply and demand and drive the price of baits way up. And I know people are looking very far and wide, so to speak, to find other safe sources of bait right now. It's really too early to tell what the overall impact will be. I think you'll see individuals fish very differently. Times in the springtime, for instance, where they may not be as profitable, maybe they'll give up some spring fishing and save bait and save that for when they know the big run of lobsters are going to be coming.
Could alewives be used?
Alewives are a very important seasonal bait, but you have to remember we could harvest every alewife that swims into the Gulf of Maine and not even put a dent in the overall bait deficit that we're facing.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments for Marine Resources Commissioner Pat Kelleher. The number again, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Otelco, formerly OTT Communications. From phones to fiber, serving Maine businesses for more than a century, Otelco.com. Here's your Vote 2018 debate schedule for the remainder of today. Here on Maine Public Radio this afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll be broadcasting the Senate debate. On Maine Public Television, this evening we'll have the Senate debate at 8:30 after Washington Week, and then the First District debate following that at 9:30 this evening. We have debates running on both radio and television this weekend. You'll find the schedule at mainepublic.org. Click on Your Vote. With the election just around the corner, a reminder, you'll find analysis of the important issues, in-depth interviews, and profiles of the candidates, our Maine Calling candidate interviews, and more at mainepublic.org/yourvote, or click on the Your Vote banner on the mainepublic.org homepage.
Hi, it's Jennifer Rooks, here to remind you that all of our Your Vote 2018 candidate interviews are available online. Visit mainpublic.org for candidate profiles, a list of the ballot questions, the latest election news, our debate broadcast schedule, and ways to rewatch or listen again to those debates, as well as the main calling programs featuring the candidates running for national or statewide office. Just click over to the Your Vote page at mainpublic.org. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we're talking about Maine's marine resources. Joining me in our Augusta studio, Pat Kelleher, Commissioner of the Department of Marine Resources for the state of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to the phones in a minute to Peter in Portland, but I have to ask about shrimp. It's about that time when we anticipate whether there will be a shrimp fishery or not. There haven't, has not been for a few years now.
It's too early to tell how the other states are going to vote on this. It's Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts make up the shrimp section at ASMFC. Shrimp surveys continue to show us at incredibly low levels, historically low still. I'm not confident at all that we're going to see any kind of fishery based on this. However, I'm personally at the point where if warming waters is the factor, is the major factor here, which it is, do we continue to just say no fishery, or do we find a way to allow a very low-level fishery, a do-no-harm fishery, to happen, to keep a little bit of shrimp on the market? It's a traditional fare. I personally think there is a way that we can do this while we continue to monitor the population and hope to see some rebounding in the future. And hopefully we would see a shift. This happened back in the 50s, and we had a pulse of warm water coming to the Gulf of Maine. Shrimp numbers collapsed, but the shrimp, as the water temperature changed, the shrimp came back. They're very temperature sensitive. The problem we have here is instead of a few years of warm water, we're now looking at kind of a decadal situation. So, you know, this may be the first species that is lost completely from a commercial standpoint. And it's tough. It's tough for the fishermen. I mean, there's a lot of history here with this industry with shrimp, and it would be nice to see something.
When will we decide?
Next month, I think the final decision will be made.
Let's go to the phones to Peter in Portland. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Commissioner. Great show. Lots of topics of concern to everyone in Maine, and especially the coastal communities and the fishing communities. My question is a little bit different because here in the state's largest city, we have a huge amount of economic pressure along our wharves, and it's starting to have an impact on the available space and the price of that space. That's going to eventually, we fear, price out our lobstermen and our fishermen off the wharves. They're all privately owned, as you probably know. So we have a little different situation than some other communities in New England. So my question is, and we're currently undertaking signature gathering for a referendum in May here in Portland. We did one in 1989. And since 1989, the zoning has become weaker. It's been weakened by several rewrites, and there's been a broader push and an encouragement for a more mixed use along our wharves. And it's gotten to the point in Portland, which we're starting to see major proposals for hotels, parking garages, and the removal of that water-dependent land from the equation. So I'm wondering,
Peter, go ahead. We're just trying to get to your question.
What the state's role in assisting the planning process, and what can they do for communities like Portland who are facing these questions? Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, Peter, that's a great question. Working waterfront and access to the water for our commercial fishermen is is really a critical component. Through the Land for Maine's Future program, there is a working waterfront access program. There's usually a few million dollars that go to help protect usually smaller wharfs and gaining and maintaining access for some of the small harbors. It's been used widely. It has been a very, very successful program here in the state. It's a much different scale in Portland. All you have to do is drive down Commercial Street and see the development. And it's something that I personally have a lot of concerns about. We need to make sure that we're maintaining access, and we need to find some certainty, frankly, for commercial fishermen on the waterfront in Portland. And I'm not it's something very different as far as how the state should be involved. I think the city needs to really step up here. I think the city needs of Portland needs to make sure they're giving some very strong indications to the commercial fishing industry, which is a key critical component of their economy still. It's changed. It's not the big draggers down there. It's lobster boats. It's the herring boats coming in. But that ground fishery is it will change and will come back, and we need to make sure that infrastructure is there, that the ice is there, that the dockage is there, and the city needs to play a critical role. The state's role, potentially through DECD and other agencies, along with the Department of Marine
That's
Resources,
economic and
community economic and community development. Yes, may be able to play a role. I'm not sure exactly what that would be, but we have to have a seat at the table, and we need to make sure that we maintain it as a priority.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Willis in Owl's Head. Hi, Willis. Welcome to the program.
Hello. I want to start with I'm not a fisherman. I'm not involved with the bait industry. I'm not involved with fishing in any manner. I'm just a regular citizen. I have a laundry list of environmental concerns, one of which is invasive species. And it seems like the bait industry has an opportunity to help with that. The Asian carp has infested the Mississippi and is still moving northward. It seems as though it would be an incredibly easy bait source and a win-win situation overall. There are train lines that run straight into Portland and Rockland. I'd love to hear your comments about that. Thank you.
So that is the species that I mentioned earlier. So Asian carp are a great bait source. They're being used now. We would like to see an expansion of that use. However, they do carry diseases, and we need to make sure that if we are going to utilize Asian carp as a bait source, that we are getting them from a safe area. I have recently learned that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service actually pays people to remove Asian carp. If we could figure out a way to turn that model to allowing people to commercially remove them and have the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service do lot testing to ensure that what is harvested would be safe, that may be a very good way to bring to fix one problem from an invasive species problem in the middle of the country and help solve some of our bait problem here in the state of Maine.
All right, let's go to Ken in Litchfield. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you. Just curious, you see the commercial fishing methods that are used today with aerial assistance, following the bait balls, the volume that these commercial outfits are able to draw in, it keeps depleting the fish stocks, not just in the herring and the bait fish, but in regular fish as well. What is being done on a state level, federal level, and international level in order to try to keep these fish stocks up, because they can't survive with the type of fishing methods that are being used?
Yeah, certainly technology has changed fishing, even lobster fishing, the amount of technology on the boats to ensure that people are placing traps very specifically on the bottom. Those type of technologies have been a major contributing factor in the ground fish fishery, within the herring fishery, as far as helping increase catches. So it really becomes paramount for the managers, both at the state, regional, and federal level, to set quota levels that are sustainable. that let the industry continue to use their technology, but ensure that they're only harvesting a sustainable amount of fish from whether it's herring, whether it's menhaden. Menhaden fishery is a great example where they use airplanes to find the schools, and then the boats will go in and then seine those schools.
So how does that formula work? Do you look at how quickly they're being caught? In other words, the volume and amount of trips, and say at that rate we need to set a different quota.
Yeah, so every one of these species is, you know, we utilize our best available science, and sometimes the best available science isn't as good as we'd like. But models are developed, the data sets, both from both the harvest data, but as well as survey data from trawl surveys or whatever that survey may bring, would be put into these models, and those models help determine what sustainable harvest levels should be.
Let's go to Bill in Booth Bay Harbor. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm just a little curious. I live down in Southport, just the other side of Booth Bay Harbor, and I have to cross the West Harbor Pond Road, and I see the biologist down there dubbing around all the time, and I'm wondering if he's catching eels or alewives and what they're up to.
Yeah, that's a great question. So as part of the work that we're required to do for our eel fishery, in particular the elver fishery, any state that has an elver fishery is required to do a life cycle survey. And we've started that here in Cobsey Stream. However, we're not seeing the catches of yellow eels and silver eels. So we shifted to West Harbor Pond. We have we've had a long-term Young of the Year survey there going on decades now, but we just started doing some eel potting there to catch, do a mark and recapture survey of yellow eels. So that's the work that we're doing down there.
All right, Bill, thanks very much. Speaking of eels, this is a good way to segue into some of the potential that's happening, the growth in the aquaculture industry. And some of these sectors are not without some controversy, which we might get to. But eels in particular, there is an eel growing operation that we covered in part of our recent aquaculture series, that there's a link to it on our Facebook page and on the site. But it's an interesting story of rather than shipping elvers, as we have been doing, out of the country, we're growing them here to adult size and putting them on tables.
It's the only model that really makes sense for the long term. Right now, for the last 30 plus years, we've been harvesting elvers out of our rivers and streams, shipping those to Japan and China and Korea for them to be grown out, processed, and then shipped back as sushi or a smoked eel product. And I think if we can find ways to continue to develop the grow-out technology here, and that's the work that Sarah Rademacher is doing that you talked about, and others are looking at this expansion as well, it's a way to keep those jobs here in the United States. The market is here.
I was going to say, there is a market for eel here.
There is a great market for eels here in the States. You know, go to any sushi restaurant, and eel will be one of the predominant items on the menu.
And there's also the sort of the European style smoked eel dishes.
While we're catching them here, we might as well retain them here and grow them out here. And I think this is the first step in doing that.
Let's go to Elihu in Denmark. And I'm guessing it's Denmark, Maine?
That it is. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I am a 60-year-old man, and I remember when I was a kid, when things were in season, we ate those. And when they were not, we didn't. Just because we can send lobsters to China doesn't mean we should. In the time of global warming, they have lobsters there. They just don't have quad lobsters. In Norway, we ship them there as well. Now they're invading their own species with our own lobsters. There's a problem with the fisheries, and it's called too many humans. When are we going to start asking the question about limiting human population on our planet?
Well, luckily, that's not something I manage, so that's going to have to be up to somebody else, I'm afraid.
Elihu, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Tom in Bangor. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. My question is for Commissioner Kelleher. I managed a fishing co-op in Pemaquid Harbor for a number of years, and we caught shrimp by trapping them. And the trapped shrimp have let go of their eggs. So if we were going to have a shrimp fishery at all, wouldn't it make sense to catch only the shrimp that had no eggs on them? I realize that third, fourth, and fifth year shrimp are all females. They're protanderic hermaphrodites. But if we could especially figure out a way to catch only the fifth-year shrimp by mesh size or something like that, we would not take something out of the population that would do anything other than die of old age.
All right, Tom, thank you. I guess the same idea as lobster management.
Yeah, yeah, and that's something that we've been talking about at ASMFC for the last several years. I completely agree from a trap perspective, where you're trapping the bigger fish after egg drop.
How does that explain what that means?
So the larger shrimp are usually the shrimp that trap the best, and usually they're catching the fish or the shrimp after egg drop, and we're seeing very few egged out shrimp in that trap catch.
And what is a trap? What is a shrimp trap?
It looks like a lobster.
Oh, really?
It looks like
okay.
a lobster trap. Yep, yep. It's the smallest proportion of the fishery, but I agree. It's one that does make great sense. However, we are looking at different technologies with the drag fishery as well for shrimp, and there are different types of grates and double grates that allow the smaller shrimp to pass through. So you're only retaining those bigger shrimp, those five-year-old shrimp that are going to die anyway. So that has to be part of the conversation that we have if we're going to have a do-no-harm fishery.
1-800-399-3566. We're talking with Pat Kelleher, Maine's Commissioner of Marine Resources. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to all.
In Florida, people with felony convictions who want to gain back the right to vote sometimes have to go in front of the governor and ask.
I move to grant. I deny.
Number 84.
This is a bad idea. I should have just left it be.
Now the state might pass an amendment that could get rid of these hearings and give voting rights back to those with felony convictions. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio.
In the midst of our nation's opioid epidemic, some drug users are coming back from the dead.
I know I was dead for 4 minutes by the time the ambulance got there.
When you put that Narcan in you, I mean, it's like scrubbing bubbles. It just goes right through you so fast.
Risky choices and safety nets, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Join us this Sunday morning at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the state of our coastal resources. My guest is Pat Kelleher, Maine's Commissioner of Marine Resources. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Brunswick. And David, hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Yes, Commissioner. How are you today?
Doing great, David.
Yes, thank you. I'm David Clark, and I'm from Brunswick. I live on McCoyet Bay, and November 15th, the DMR will be hearing a very, very large 40-acre oyster aquaculture site, and I'm a concerned citizen, and I understand the state's push and need to develop new revenue resource, you know, sources via aquaculture, but I'd like to know what we can do, Commissioner, as private citizens and taxpayers to have, I would say, kind of like more say in the process of how these sites are approved. It seems as though the size and the scope of this project is way, way too big, and the impacts, I don't think, have been fully vetted at this point. So I'd like your ideas on this, please.
Yeah. All right, David, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So I have to be very careful here because this is an ongoing hearing process. I am the final decision maker in this, and so I have to base my opinion based on the entire record of the hearing and the public comments that come in. In general, I will say that it's very important for the public to maintain engagement through this process, whether it's through intervening status or whether it's coming to the public hearings and giving testimony at the public hearings. We hear testimony a lot at the public hearings that are not part of our decision-making criteria. We have a very specific set of laws that we have to use and that I have to weigh to make a final decision in any aquaculture lease that is granted. Through that process, we have denied aquaculture leases. We've approved them as they've been presented, and we've modified them in size and shape.
So you could shrink it, approve it, but shrink it.
Yeah, yeah. So those are the type of things that, based on the comments and the criteria that is defined in law, that's what I would utilize to make a final decision when it comes to granting a lease. But please remain part of the process. It is very important that the public attend these hearings, comment on these hearings, but comment specific to the criteria that's in law.
There was a caller who couldn't stay on the line but was asking about a controversial on-land salmon farm that's being weighed in Belfast.
Yes.
There's another one in Bucksport. Yeah. But just to clarify, that's not under your jurisdiction.
No, land-based aquaculture is part of the Department of Conservation, Agriculture, Forestry. So they deal with that. We still comment on it because we will comment as it pertains to biosecurity issues and the wastewater side of this. We'll comment on through the DEP permit process. We do have a role because we do have to approve any importation of salmon for that facility or either facility if they're coming from outside the country. So that would be a different part of that process, but we would maintain a role in the importation.
All right, let's go to Hudson and Sandy. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My question to the commissioner concerns the industrial harvest of rockweed. And as some of our commercial fisheries have gone away, I'm most familiar with the fisheries in Washington County, and a lot of fishermen have turned to harvesting the rockweed raw on our coastline, which is kind of the nursery and the basic building block for the whole marine food chain. And it's one thing if people are harvesting by hand, because I think that's fairly sustainable. But now they go out with these, they look like giant shop vacs, and they just vacuum up the rockweed so that entire ledges along the coastline are left bare. And I'm seeing more and more of that in both Maine and the Maritimes. And I'm wondering what's sustainable and are we doing anything about that at the state level? Thank you.
Yeah, if you...
What is the value of rockweed first, just so we understand the market?
I didn't bring the overall... The overall value of the harvested rockweed, frankly, is very low. It's what they use the rockweed for after it's been processed that has a very high value.
In
the commercial products, yeah. Whether it's animal feed or food. There are regulations on the books that if the caller ever sees a ledge that has been stripped bare, they need to call the Maine Marine Patrol immediately because that is an illegal harvest. There is a 16-inch cutting height. Frankly, the machines that are used are very good at maintaining the proper cutting height, the way they're set up and the way they cut. They're certainly more efficient than a hand harvester. There are less than 8 mechanical harvesters on the coast right now, but I certainly understand the caller's concern as it pertains to their efficiency. I think that is something that's going to be talked about in the future as it pertains to rockweed harvesting. Right now, we're kind of in limbo with rockweed management because we're waiting for the state's highest court to make a ruling on who owns the rockweed. We at the department, very early on in my tenure as commissioner, I advanced the development of a fisheries management plan for rockweed. We want to move that forward, but until the court rules, and I know which direction we need to move in. We're going to continue to monitor the fishery, ensure that we're enforcing any illegal harvest, and at the time we get a ruling, we'll determine what direction we'll go in as far as new rules.
And this is because it's in a tidal zone? And
yes. We manage this as a fishery. It derives its nutrients from the water, not the soil. And because of that, we've always, as a state, managed it as a fishery. Landowners have challenged that and taken the industry to court and said that it is not a fishery. It is a plant, and it belongs to us. So that is what is being determined by the court now.
All right, let's go to Ty in Sanford. Hi, Ty.
Yeah, hi. Very interesting and enlightening show. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a recreational fisherman. I go on charter boats, and I really, really enjoy it. We haven't been able to keep caught for a couple of years. I was wondering if the commissioner could, give me an idea of when I could look forward to harvesting some cod again out of the Gulf of Maine. Thank you.
Yeah, Ty, I wish I could say that it's right now, but the cod stocks continue to be managed very conservatively.
But aren't they doing better?
They are doing better. They are doing better. I was just talking to a commercial fisherman the other day, and they're seeing more and more cod all the time. The science, though, is not, and the assessment work is not reflecting that yet. I think we need to find a way, though, for a recreational harvester and somebody that's fishing on a headboat, find a way for them to keep a fish or two, because at the end of the day, you have catch and release mortality with those fish. They're not all going to live once they're released. And I would rather see one or two fish that are being brought aboard that may not live to be able to return in a cooler and to be utilized by a family. I think that's would be the best use for them. And hopefully we'll get to that point soon.
We've only got about a minute or so left. We'll go to David in Kennebunk. Hi, David.
Hi there. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I have a couple of historical points. I'm almost 70, but when I grew up in Massachusetts, I saw in the rivers around Lake Assawamset herring so thick that you couldn't even believe it. And when we traveled up to New Hampshire, we also saw the same thing. And when we traveled to Maine, we also saw in all of the small rivers at that time of the year just so much abundant herring. It was almost like going into an apple orchard and thinking that world should never go hungry. And what happened?
Well, I'm assuming what you were seeing were river herring, and the populations of river herring in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, basically south of Maine, have really declined. We've done a tremendous amount of work here in the state of Maine to restore our rivers. We're not seeing any impacts by any of the midwater fleet when it comes to our river herring. We're seeing growth in our river herring runs. We still sustainably harvest 18 of our runs. There are very few runs that are being harvested to the south of Maine now. And it's a habitat issue to the south. I firmly believe that the loss of habitat has been the biggest contributing factor into the decline of river herring throughout its range.
And what's the habitat that's been lost?
Loss of fish passage issues. I mean, from a hydropower dam to a non-regulated dam to road crossings. People don't think of these small streams and culverts as having any impact, but they're one of the biggest contributing factors to declines of our native fish when it comes that have to utilize the freshwater portions of the ecosystem.
David, I know you said you had a second historical point. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to have to just ask one final question in the next 30 seconds or so. What's the one thing that keeps you up at night with respect to your job as Commissioner of Marine Resources?
It's not that I can't make it grouse hunting this weekend with my dogs. A lot of things keep me up at night. I mean, a changing environment is the biggest contributing factor to the work that we do overall. But when you talk about a lobster fishery that makes up over 75% of the economic contributions of our commercial fishery, that's too many eggs in one basket. And trying to figure out how to solve those and continue to work on those things is really a primary driver of the agency.
Pat Kelleher, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Pat Kelleher is Commissioner of Maine's Department of Marine Resources. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Thanks also to Gil Maxwell for help with the program. You can also find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. And a reminder, as we approach Election Day, you can find our earlier Maine Calling Your Vote candidate interviews at mainepublic.org. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.